The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty.
No one else but Gordon Lightfoot, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore powerful stories of survival and loss, a new collection of Lake Superior's shipwrecks and ghost ships, these vessels that sank without a trace. You can call in, join the conversation with your question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael Schumacher is here, Wisconsin author of Great Lakes Shipwrecks. His book is called Too Much Sea for Their Decks, Shipwrecks of Minnesota's North Shore and Isle Royale. Michael, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, your account of the Matafa stands out as an example of how violent the waters of Lake Superior can be. What makes Lake Superior waters so ferocious?
I think they're all ferocious, actually, all of the Great Lakes. The word is the worst of the storms, the most vicious of the storms, are actually on Lake Erie, only because it's the smallest of the lakes. It's fairly shallow, and the waves build up tremendously. And they're all bad, let's put it that way. I'm working on a book right now on the shipwrecks of Lake Michigan. And they have had more ships go down Lake Michigan than the other four lakes combined. And a lot of boats, you know, have gone down. What makes them... It's really interesting because I've lived on Lake Michigan the better part of my life. I'm looking out my window right now at the lake, and if you see big heavy waves near the shore, you don't want to be in the middle of the lake because the waves are breaking up by the time they reach shore. So. In other words, if it's bad here, think of what it's like in the middle of the lake. And Superior, being the biggest lake, it doesn't have as many ports that ships can duck into.
For shelter.
You think of it as a big lake, but so much of it is just lake. It's undeveloped by the shore. Now, you know, you get to Erie, and they're all, because it's such a small lake compared, there are more places that they can duck out of trouble, you know, and the Matafa is an incredibly interesting story to me from that standpoint, because they left Duluth and were going somewhere, realized how bad the storm was, and they were returning to Duluth, and they had their big problems at the entry of the harbor.
And it's at the entry of the harbor, you have all these people watching a ship go down helpless. They can't help. That is just, it's so strange that you have a ship that you can see. It's just right there, and there's no way for people to help.
That was what really amazed me about this. Well, there were a lot of things about that Matafa story that's amazing. But that the people were standing in with sub-zero weather, and they built fires, and they were trying to just be a presence to encourage the people on the Matafa to try to get them to survive the mess. For people unfamiliar with the story, the Matafa was trying to turn into the entry to the harbor at Duluth, and a wave swept it into, and it hit a wall, and then it was pushed back and hit another wall, and it broke. It literally split the back end and the front end. It was still in one piece, but huge cracks appeared on it, and the people that were in the back of the ship were helpless because of the formation of that particular boat. Most of the boats that were being put out there, and I should mention, that I call them boats because that's what they call them. If it's ocean going, it's a ship. If it's Great Lakes, is a boat. Because the Metapa was a gigantic ship. And when the boats that were being built in that period had a big deck house in the front and a big housing unit in the back. And the crew quarters were, different.
Mm-hmm.
And the Metapa did not have the back end deck house. There was nowhere to go. And the men that were trapped in the back of the boat were literally trapped on the boat. The boat started to sink, the back end of it. It filled with water, and they had to get out of there. And the only place to go was outside.
Mm, mm.
And they all died. Every single one of them perished. Three people made it to the front of the boat while there was still a possibility. In other words, water is being swept over the deck. It's very, very slippery, and you can die just being swept overboard in those kind of seas. Three people made it. Nobody else even attempted it, and everybody else died.
I'm just going to reintroduce you here for a moment as we talk with Michael mm-hmm. Schumacher. Sixth book on shipwrecks in the Great Lakes, and you can join in your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Another just incredible story is Kamloops.
Yes.
You cite underwater archaeologist who said in 1927, yeah. Kamloops shipwreck is more shrouded in mystery than any other wreck at Isle Royale.
Right.
Isle Royale being this, island in the middle of Lake Superior. What makes this story so mysterious?
Well, it was a strange story because I talked to the men that found it. I talked to the shipwreck hunters, as I like to be known, that found the boat. It was one of those things that went down. It went down, if memory serves, the Kamloops went down in 1927. And it went down in the middle of a terrible storm. And I've always said, to interrupt myself briefly, that a boat doesn't just sink for one reason. They generally have several things that combine to make it happen. In the Kamloops, that story was interesting to me because they had radios back in those days. The Kamloops did not. It was not equipped with the ship-to-shore communications. So nobody knew what had happened to it. And it sank near the Isle Royale, but nobody knew for sure. But they had a good idea that that's where it happened. And they sent boats out to look for survivors or the boat itself and didn't find it. Well, what made the Kamloops such a tragic story to me was they got off the boat. Most of the people got off the boat, got into lifeboats, and went to the island. Well, the island's not totally developed at that point. And they get on shore, and they have no way to stay warm, to get out of the elements. They made some homemade shelters, and they were waiting for somebody to find them. Nobody did until the following spring. And at that point, of course, everyone was gone. And so there's that story. There's the story of the search for the vessel over the years. One of the things people have to realize, too, is that we didn't have the equipment to look for these boats.
No sonar, no, right. Mm-hmm.
There's no sonar side scans and the diving equipment. There was no Aqualung until the late 40s.
Mm.
So people couldn't really dive very deep. So these boats would disappear. They become like ghost ships. And the Kamloops just became it captured people's imaginations because they did find a note that the last survivor wrote before she passed away about how she was all that was left and she was going to die, but she wanted people to know this is what happened. And so these are the kinds of things that people really are empathetic about.
Great Lakes Shipwrecks historian Michael Schumacher, new book capturing how powerful storms could bring down even the mightiest freighters trying to move cargo across Lake Superior. You can join in throughout this conversation. Call in with a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
Oftentimes have we laid out toil, no danger fearing.
Long we've tossed on the rolling main, now we're safe ashore, Jack. Don't forget your old shipmate. Folly, rolly, 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 ride. Oh, long we've tossed on the rolling main.
Safe and sound at home again, let the waters roar, Jack. Safe and sound at home again, let the waters roar, Jack.
Long we've tossed on the rolling main, now we're safe ashore, Jack. Don't forget your old shipmate. Folly, rolly, 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 ride-o.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Encounters with intense storms are part of a sailor's job. Great Lakes historian Michael Schumacher takes us into the harrowing moments of survival and loss. 13 shipwrecks, 3 killer storms on Lake Superior. Latest book is called Too Much Sea for Their Decks. Share what you wonder about shipwrecks. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael, shipbuilders in Duluth developed the whaleback style of ship. How did design improve upon previous shipbuilding?
Well, it was weird because when they were building the whalebacks, which weren't popular for very long, I want to say maybe 20 years at the maximum, because they had downsides too. But what they liked about it, the designer, is that they sat low in the water so that in storms, the stuff would wash over them. It wouldn't mount, you know, the ship and then get in through all kinds of openings and sink the ship. That worked. Now, the downside of the whaleback was, for listeners that might not know about it, it was cigar-shaped. They called it a pig boat, too, because at the bow of the ship, it looked like a pig's snout. And they set, when they were fully loaded, they set really well deep into the water so that it was hard to see. And back when that was developed, the technology for that in the late 1800s, they didn't have the kind of ship-to-shore communications that they would eventually have. So you could, or ship-to-ship, even more important.
Mm-hmm.
So the whaleback could be in a shipping lane and other boats wouldn't see it, because it was sitting so far down in the water. And so as a result, they were rammed. There is one whaleback in existence, and it's really pretty interesting to me. It's in Wisconsin Superior.
SS Meteor Whaleback Ship Museum?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And you can actually go on the boat. Mm-hmm. You can't in the winter months because it's not heated, apparently. Or at least that's what I was told. But they're very interesting to see. And it's the only one that exists. All the other ones were either scrapped or sunk. And so this is a part of our sort of maritime history that is of interest to people. And the whaleback was, to me, one of the more fascinating boats that I ever studied, just because it was so different. Now, the one that was sunk, the Wilson, which was sunk right after the turn of the 20th century, was in, like, I believe, 1902 or something like that. It was sunk right in by the Duluth Harbor, by the entry, you know, where the big, they've got the big transfer bridge there and everything that welcomes you sort of to the harbor. It's for people who haven't seen it, it's, to me, it's the most beautiful harbor I've ever seen. It's really, but it has its issues.
And now you have this Thomas Wilson that is such a navigational hazard for other boats that want to use the port.
Exactly so. And another boat rammed it, and it sank, and it sank pretty fast, the Wilson did. I want to say it sank in about 10 minutes. You know, it went under, and it lost a bunch of people. The one guy that survived was kind of interesting because he'd been – that was like, I believe, his third shipwreck that he'd been on boats that sank. And I'm thinking, boy, I'd probably want to find another line of work if I was like that. But sailors are an interesting lot, I've found. They're very interesting. One of the things that attracts me to shipwrecks are the men themselves, that there's nothing sexy about working on the lakes. There just isn't. You're doing hard work. You're out there in the middle of nowhere. Like if you get out on the Superior, you can go a couple of days without even seeing land. And these guys are doing hard work, as good blue collar work. And all of a sudden, these men find themselves in a situation for which they may have heard, but they're not prepared. You know, you really have no idea what it's like to be in a shipwreck till you're in one. And to me, I find that very, very interesting. How do they do this? How do they handle it? How do they survive?
And what's interesting to me is as you go through these shipwrecks, you note that as these boats are sinking, you said it multiple times, the mood on the deck is calm. Why do you think that was?
I think part of it is that so many boats have sunk that have had survivors, where people have saved them, either on lifeboats or in the water, that these guys have a certain, if they stay calm, panic only hurts. A panicked survivor is probably not going to survive for long. But if you hold yourself as sort of an even keel, if you'll pardon the boat reference, you're probably going to do better.
Your odds of surviving are better. You're more clear-headed.
Yes. And a lot of people have been saved over the years. We remember the ones that died, and we should. These are people who gave up their lives doing a tough job. But they're also, it's fascinating that so many did survive, and to hear their stories. And for this particular book, Too Much Sea for Their Decks, I was very, very fortunate. There is an archivist at the University of Wisconsin Superior who helped me out enormously in this book. Her name is Laura, and I'm blowing her last name now. It's not immediately coming to mind, but she's helped others as well. What she has up there is an overwhelmingly good archives. And by that, I mean, I got testimony, the transcripts of testimony that survivors had given to the Coast Guard. And they told you every step of the way about the sinking.
And it's interesting how those testimonies were delivered sometimes just a matter of hours or days after these people had survived this horrible, horrible accident.
Well, part of that was necessary.
Okay.
Your memory's going to slide a little bit in time. And part of it is for, I guess, insurance and such purposes. They want to know as much as they can, as soon as they can. There are reasons for it. And the testimony, especially if you talk to the crewmen, the people that were in the pilot house, when this happened, the captains and the first mates and the wheelsmen and things like that, they saw so much that it their testimony was you were like you were there. And this person up in UW-Superior had so many things that had never been seen really before. You know, and I was
that enables you to give a more detailed account of these shipwrecks. I'm going to reintroduce you here, Wisconsin author Michael Schumacher. Sixth book on Great Lakes shipwrecks. It's a collection of final trips and foundering that are powerful stories in their context of shipping history. Room to discuss? Call in with a question, a comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
And singer in the lowland sea. Oh, I will give you silver and I will give you gold and the hand of me daughter if you will be so bold as to swim alongside of that Turkish enemy. And he sank beneath the lowland, lowland, low. He sank beneath the lowland sea. Oh, there is a lofty ship and she sails on the sea. Oh, there was a lofty ship, and she sailed on the sea, and the name of that ship it was the Golden Vanity, and she feared she will be taken by a Turkish enemy. As she sailed on the lowland, lowland, low, she sailed on the lowland sea.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a collection of Lake Superior shipwrecks in an era where there were no ways to track down boats gone missing in deep, frigid waters. Michael Schumacher's book is called Too Much Sea for Their Decks, and you can join the conversation at any point. The number to ask a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is a great topic. So I'm a shipwreck diver. I've spent my whole life diving these shipwrecks in the Great Lakes. I got to work with Michael in a very small way on his book on the Carl D. Bradley, which is one of the wrecks that I've dove. But I wanted to point out that people are still visiting these shipwrecks. Many of them are well-preserved by the deep, cold waters of the Great Lakes. And they're wonderful time capsules where you can go and see how things were exactly when the ships sank.
John, what is your favorite dive? What has been the most memorable to you?
That would have to be when we removed the bell from the Carl D. Bradley, and it's now on display in Rogers City, Michigan. And then we put a memorial bell back in place on top of the pilot house. That was the most memorable and special dive to me.
Michael, what are your thoughts on these dives?
Well, first of all, John, it's good to talk to you. Also, I'd like to say that Carl Bradley is a very, very special ship to me, and it's a very special book to me. And that dive to remove the bell, I was very lucky in the respect that they brought the bell up, and it was all tarnished and beat up. And I got to touch that bell, and that meant something because the bell is like the soul of the ship. And they had it redone. I think Michigan State did it. I can't remember for sure. But they restored it to like it looked brand new. And that is so special. And I went up to the 50th anniversary memorial that they did up in Rogers City for the Carl Bradley. That's a very, very special city to me, and the people. I love the people up there. I that book, I did over 200 interviews for that book, and it meant so much to me. And it's so great to be able to talk to somebody that is actually connected to that, because that's a Lake Michigan shipwreck. When we were talking about doing this book about my editor and I, when I say we, when we were talking about doing a book about Lake Michigan, he says, you've never done one. And I said, maybe my best book was done on a shipwreck from Lake Michigan. And that was the wreck of the Carl D. So that's all my background on it. It means a great deal to me.
John, thanks for calling in. You know, as we talk about these deep expeditions, how would divers bring up or salvage the boilers and the engine on these vessels? How is that even possible?
It's very interesting to me, that whole thing, is very, very fascinating to me, because there was a guy named Reed that was one of the very first to do this on the Great Lakes. And I wrote an introduction to a book that was written about his life. They came up with the most innovative ways of bringing these things up that you can imagine. They found out how to refloat them. They'd use all sorts of devices just to bring, because anybody that's ever seen a engine from one of these boats, they're not small. And the same can be said about the boilers. And they can be reused and have been reused many times. And when they're, when a boat goes down, and it's really funny because I'm writing about one right now, called the Appomattox, that went down in the early 1900s. And they brought the boilers and the engines up in that. And if I remember correctly, Reed was involved in that in some capacity. It's impossible really to describe, because they vary from wreck to wreck. They will send somebody down. Today, it's a lot different, because they can dive the wrecks. And the Appomattox is only down in 20 feet of water. So that also is, it's very helpful, you know, for some of that.
Was looting an issue now or then?
It isn't anymore so much.
Okay.
It was then. These people would go down and they'd just take anything they could remove from the ship. And it could be a big problem. It was a problem even with some of the more famous ones. The Kamloops is a great example. They stripped that boat of just about everything that they could take off of it once it was found and once the location was known. That's one of the things a lot of these shipwreck hunters, they don't like to give out locations if they can help it. They have to eventually, but because of the looting that's involved. The Kamloops is kind of fun because they still have cases and cases of lifesavers on it. They were shipping lifesavers amongst other things, and they're still there, and you can still see them. They have since passed laws where you can't loot. And it makes for an interesting situation, because the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum in Whitefish Point, Michigan, has a lot of things that were taken off of boats, or even in the Edmund Fitzgerald. They've got some of the Edmund Fitzgerald stuff. People passed laws that prohibit that. The Fitzgerald's an interesting study, because you can't even visit that shipwreck anymore. You cannot photograph that shipwreck anymore, because it's in Canadian water, not by much, I think by about 100 yards, but it's in Canadian water, and the Canadian government passed a law that says no more, which is, to me, in a way, because I'm not an underwater archaeologist like a lot of these people are, that's a grave site. 29 men lost their lives on that boat, and presumably they're all still on that boat. And, you know, it's a grave site. And so what people take off of these ships and how much they disturb them, that's changed dramatically over the years, where you can't do that anymore. They had permission, I should note, to take the bells off both the Fitzgerald and the Carl Bradley. They took them all off. They're in museums now. They're wonderful to see. You know, if you find yourself at a shipwreck museum that's got one of these bells, it's really something. There's something about it that I can't explain, that is just, it's very moving.
I'm going to reintroduce you here, Michael Schumacher, sixth book on shipwrecks in the Great Lakes. You can join the conversation at any point. Call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. Michael, earlier we were talking about Coast Guard testimony, and there were some interesting changes to life preservers that came out of some testimony. I think it was with the Henry Steinbrenner's sinking in 1953. What did you make about changes that address safety?
You know, it's really interesting to me because the ship companies, but the sailors also, they're very reluctant to change anything, even for safety's sake. And they really had to fight to get some of these changes made. And it used to be that there, you know, some of the boats that I'm covering on this new book, they had like three or four lifeboats. They couldn't begin to cover all the passengers. Well, the Titanic changed a lot of that, where they all of a sudden had to have enough boats to have, you know, to contain all the passengers on the board. But there have been a lot of them. The radio activity. It used to be you didn't have to have a radio. Well, now you do. And the lifesavers, it was like that. They didn't even have enough lifesavers on a lot of these boats for all the passengers they took on. And the types of lifesavers. When I covered the Carl Bradley, that was one interesting case, was they had life preservers, but the people, when they started to suffer from hypothermia, your body changes. And by that, I mean it. When they found the people that perished on the Carl Bradley, they were all in the same position in the water, and that's in the fetal position. That's how you die, apparently, from hypothermia. That's the position you take. Now, some of the people, however, had slipped through the life preservers. So now they have different ones. They have ones with like crotch straps and stuff like that, which you can't slip through. But each one of these processes of changing safety has been a long, hard. They've now got these devices you can crawl into, and when the ship sinks, it breaks free, and you're safe. You're out of the elements, you know. But it took them forever to get some of this stuff passed.
Can you talk about
gun control laws? People keep dying, but we don't pass laws.
Can you talk about why so many of these storms occur in November?
Yes. It's the transition month, as they like to call it. The water tends to be still as warm as it gets. It doesn't get real warm. I challenge anybody to step into Superior and say that's a warm lake. Because I thought I knew cold till the first time I set foot in Lake Superior.
Here, here.
But it does warm up somewhat. But in November, the air temperatures are dropping and dropping suddenly. And when they pass over the warm water, it creates an effect that you don't have in other months of the year. You also have Canadian storm systems that will set in. And the beginning point is largely November. So all kinds of different circumstances happen that affects the sailing conditions. It's been known forever that it's not a good time to sail, but people do. They had what they called heavy weather captains, people that would go out in any kind of weather. A lot of captains weren't. You know, it's so individual to the captains. Bernie Cooper, who was right behind the Edmund Fitzgerald, was one of the good ones, but he was also a pretty heavy weather captain. And when he testified to the Coast Guard, he said he'd been in worse storms than the one that brought down the Fitzgerald. But he also made a point of saying, I've never been in a storm where it was localized as badly as it was in the Fitzgerald. In other words, certain areas of the lake were unbelievably horrible. And he thought that was one of the big contributing factors to the Fitzgerald's demise. So, you know, you almost have to study the weather on every one of these storms. When I did for this book, Too Much Sea for Their Decks, I covered three storms in the book. And I went back and studied the maps you know, that were made of the storms, tracking the storms and so forth. I read the reports of how these storms developed. And then I read the testimony of the different captains that talked about the storms, because they're all different. Everyone is different. The one in 1905 was terrible, but it was nothing.
I cut you off there. The 1905 wasn't as terrible as
the 1912. That was a literal hurricane on the lakes.
And we're going to talk about freshwater hurricanes. Great Lakes historian Michael Schumacher's sixth book is out on shipwrecks in our region. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
And if your gold mine comes up empty, I'll be there to work the claim. If you're captain of a shipwreck, I'll be first mate to your shame.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Neil Diamond, captain of a shipwreck. We have Wisconsin author Michael Schumacher, latest book on shipwrecks, this collection of lesser-known but powerful stories of survival and loss on Lake Superior. And, you know, it's, you mentioned Titanic, and we really want to ask you, what was your reaction to the tragedy of a submersible being lost while seeking to explore the wreckage of the Titanic?
Yeah, I had mixed reactions to it. First of all, people have asked me over the years, would I want to go visit such a wreck or visit even some of the ones like the Bradley is way down there and the Fitzgerald is in 500 feet of water and so forth. And my reaction was, I really don't need to. I've seen the photos. I went out to Washington, D.C. to the Coast Guard headquarters to look at their vault on the Edmund Fitzgerald. And what you see is what you see. So I personally had no real desire to see the wreck per se. And so that was hard for me to understand. But it was also hard for me to understand how they would take a boat down there or a vessel of some sort, submersible, when it wasn't better guaranteed than that one was. Now, there's all kinds of stories floating around now about the boat. I don't know anything about that. But I did. Did I follow it? You bet I did.
Well, let's take another call. Melody in Washington Island. Melody, hi.
Hi there. I was going to say that I was going to take a bit of issue with your claim that there are no sexy jobs on the lake. My father was a commercial fisherman, as was my grandfather and my great uncles. Long family tradition. And Dad kept mending other fishermen's nets until he passed away in his 90s a couple of years ago. And there was, I used to say when in the 34 years that I worked off island, that for my dad, no day was as good as the day he could be out on the lake.
Mm.
But the when you're talking about the 1912 hurricane on Lake Michigan, is that what would have been called the Labor Day blow?
No. This happened in late November. When I say it was a hurricane, it had every single box checked for what constituted a hurricane. The winds blew at such and such at 50 or above for, I forget what it was. It was unbelievable how many hours it was. And then the waves were such and such a height, and it went on and on. It fulfilled it. And most people will say it was a hurricane. We think of the hurricanes as tropical. We think of them in around this country, certainly, and in the South. But this had all the qualities of a hurricane. I want to say something, incidentally, while I'm on about commercial fishermen. I have a couple of good friends here in Kenosha, where I live, whose father was a commercial fisherman. And some of the best days I spent talking to him about commercial fishing. I had nothing but admiration and respect for him. When I think of what I meant by it isn't sexy, you know, it's not like something you could show in a movie that would, you know, gain attention immediately. It's like working down in the boiler room or something. They showed that in that movie, The Titanic, but it really was just a bunch of guys working real hard at what they were doing. You know, there wasn't anything glorious or whatever about it. The captain, now he got the glory, but the people that were doing the actual work, it's like, how like sexy is painting, you know, and they do so much painting on these boats. I have nothing but the deepest respect for the people that work on those lakes, believe me.
And Mike, I want to jump in here. And Mike in Superior is asking about how these freighters were pushing the limits of weight and wanting to know whether the Fitzgerald was overloaded and how freight capacity was perhaps partly to blame in trying to keep the shipping going on the lakes, even in conditions that were not suitable. Can you elaborate?
Yes. Yes. First of all, that's a good point, because some of these ships, I just wrote about the Ralph Simmons, which was the famed Christmas tree ship in Wisconsin that went down right about around Two Rivers. Now, that one was overloaded. It had very little freeboard. And when they hit a storm, of course, the waves were going across the decks. The Fitzgerald was not, by its standards or by fall standards, overloaded. It had 26,000 tons of taconite ore pellets on it, but it was not overloaded. Mm. You know, when you overloaded ships, and some did, and especially late in the season, they were trying to get that last run in. It was all important to make as much as they could before they had to shut it down. Sometimes they would overload it. They did get to the point where they started to have different measurements where you could, the ship could only sink in the water so far. They have those to this day. And for the fall season, you have to have more freeboard, as they call it. And in other words, from the deck to the water, you have to have more than you do during the summer where the sea isn't as rough. But have there been wrecks that have happened with overloaded boats? More than I'd like to mention.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for your interest. As you can tell, you could talk on and on and on about this.
Oh, Michael Schumacher. The book is called Too Much for Their Decks, Shipwrecks of Minnesota's North Shore and Isle Royal. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
Captain wired in, he had water coming in, and the good ship and crew was in peril. And later that night, when his lights went out of sight, came the wreck of the Edmund.